Pennsylvania and was granted what they called a probationary license to preach by the Transylvania Presbytery on January 4, 1797. He was ordained on November 7, 1797 by the Presbytery, and I quote the minutes, and set apart to the holy word of the gospel ministry by prayer and laying on of hands. That was their ordination ceremony. They had a prayer and laid their hands on him, and so he now has been ordained. He was assigned to the Eagle Creek Church in Brown County, Ohio. The fourth one was John Thompson. He came to Kentucky from North Carolina in 1795. He was licensed to exhort by the West Lexington Presbytery in April 1799. They didn't want him teaching. They did not want him preaching doctrine. They just wanted him to exhort the people after others had preached and taught them what they should do. He moved to Ohio from Kentucky in 1800, where he was eventually ordained by the Washington Presbytery of Ohio and assigned to the Springfield Presbyterian Church. The fifth one was David Pervance. David Pervance was a ruling elder in the old Cane Ridge congregation when Stone arrived in 1796. Now, they divided the eldership into at least two classes, and one of the classes they called the ruling elder, and so Pervance qualified as a ruling elder. He was a very distinguished Kentuckian. He served in the state legislature with great attention and with great distinction. He left Kentucky and went to Ohio, and there he was elected to the House of Representatives and to the State Senate, and distinguished himself not only as a preacher, but as a statesman in that land. Now, Pervance was one of the first individuals among this group to advocate immersion for baptism. That's a long story. I'm going to save part of it maybe for another night. But he required Stone to baptize him in Old Stoner Creek, that creek that runs north of Parrish, Kentucky, there that you crossed over. Had Stone to baptize him before Stone himself had been baptized. Stone didn't believe in it strongly enough to teach immersion, but Pervance did, and Stone agreed to baptize him in Old Stoner Creek. Now, Thompson and Dunleavy and McNamara attended the old log cabin seminary that was conducted by Robert Finley. So they had strong ties with the whole movement in that area and with Presbyterianism as it found its roots in this land. Now, following the Cane Ridge Revival, McNamara and Thompson were called before the Washington Presbytery and charged with heresy. Now that's a serious charge, isn't it? And all in the world they were doing was preaching the Bible. All they were doing was calling men back to the Bible and advocating that they take the Bible as their only rule of faith and practice. And the Washington Presbytery called them into account for that and charged them with heresy. Their case was referred by the Washington Presbytery in Ohio to the Kentucky Synod, which was meeting at the First Presbyterian Church in Lexington, Kentucky, in September 3-10, 1803. Now, when these charges were brought against Thompson and McNamara, the rest of the associates said, if they prove this on them, they'll charge us with the same thing, and they'll prove it, and they'll expel us. So we'd better get out of this thing while getting out is good before they expel us. And so they all withdrew. Now, one of the interesting footnotes is that Robert Marshall was the secretary to the synod. And here he got up and left his chair as the secretary to the synod and joined these individuals who had protested against the charges and had asked to be heard. Well, the synod would not hear them, and so the synod prepared the case against them and served notice on these men that they had been expelled from the presbytery and the synod and declared their pulpits vacant. And they named a committee to go to all of these Presbyterian churches where these men had been preaching and notify those churches that the pulpits were vacant. These men are no longer allowed to preach under the authority of our synod and our presbytery. There were 15 of these congregations, 8 of them in Kentucky and 7 of them in Ohio, where these men preached. And every lasting one of them, my friends, decided to renounce their allegiance to the Westminster Confession of Faith, their affiliation with the Presbyterians, and join the Restoration Movement and convert every one of these 15 churches to one after the order of the New Testament pattern. And I think that's dramatic. Now, Stone was not as convinced that they ought to leave the presbytery and the synod as some of the rest of them were. So he appealed to the presbytery and to the synod particularly to let them organize a new presbytery with these 15 churches in it, and call it the Springfield Presbytery, and let it be affiliated with the synod. Well, you can imagine that the synod said, we'll have nothing to do with that. We'll create our own presbyteries. We won't leave it for you to do as a group of heretics. But they proceeded, and in the fall of 1803, they organized what they call the Springfield Presbytery, and these 15 congregations joined in that presbytery. But in less than a year, they decided that what they had formed was just as sectarian and just as denominational, and to use his word, savored of the party spirit, just as much as the old Transylvania Presbytery or the old Kentucky Synod did. Why, here we've created a Frankenstein trying to get away from Mr. Hyde. We've done what we've been condemning all the time. We have saddled on ourselves an ecclesiastical body that has no more right to exist than the Transylvania Presbytery and the Kentucky Synod. So on June 24, 1804, they met at the old spring at the old Cane Ridge meeting house and voted to abolish the Springfield Presbytery, and they wrote the last will and testament of the Springfield Presbytery. Now let me pause to admonish you students particularly. If you haven't read the last will and testament of the Springfield Presbytery, you go to the library and get you a copy of it and read it. Because it is a basic document setting forth in succinct terms the great plea of the Restoration Movement as they saw it at that time, and you'll do well to read it. Richard Wright McNamara is thought to have written most of the Springfield Presbytery Last Will and Testament, but they all agreed to it and all of them signed it and signed their names to it. And about this time, Rice Haggard had migrated from North Carolina to Kentucky and had heard about what was going on in the Stone camp. And so Rice Haggard made his way from North Carolina to Cane Ridge. And he influenced greatly, I think, the writing of the Last Will and Testament. So greatly so that he convinced Stone and his group, just as he had convinced James O'Kelly and his group down at the Lebanon Meeting House in Surrey County, Virginia, that they ought to call themselves Christians. And so they're no longer Presbyterians now, but they are Christians. And they call themselves as individuals Christians, and they call the corporate body the Church of Christ. Looks like things are going well, aren't they? They've got the thing with the downhill pull, making great progress. We've solidified this great movement of ours, but it lasted only a year. And two disciples of the Shakers came from New England, New York, down to Brown County in Ohio and Bourbon County in Kentucky to pray on these individuals who'd broken away from denominationalism and sectarianism and see if they could not rally them as a part of the forces of the Shaker movement. They spent some time with Stone to no avail, but they went over in Brown County and put the proposition to McNamara and Dunleavy, and they fell for it. And they agreed to leave the Stone movement and join the Shaker movement, and so they did. Now there are two Shaker colonies that were built in Kentucky, and some of you may have seen them. One of them is Pleasant Hill, over in Mercer County near Harrisburg, Kentucky, and the other is down in Logan County near Russellville, Kentucky, and this was the foundation of the Shaker movement in Kentucky and albeit in the South. I always thought that McNamara and Dunleavy were the most radical of all of these individuals, and they were clear sailing for the Shakers. They were good fodder for the Shakers, and they were virgin land for the Shakers to sow their seeds and convince them, and they went with them. Stone grieved greatly over this matter, but he recovered somewhat from his grief in losing these two men until 1811. And in 1811, Robert Marshall and John Thompson decided that the Bible was too latitudinarian, and they ought to write a creed setting forth their faith in practice. Now, latitudinarian is a big word, and I had to look it up too when I first read it. But it just means that the Bible covers too much territory, and the average reader cannot take it and decide what he believes and what he ought to practice and what he ought to teach people to practice. And you ought to take a sheet of paper and write down on that what your beliefs are and what your practices are, and let that be your creed. And Thompson and Marshall argued for that. And of course Stone and Dooley and Pervine opposed it. And so they decided to meet in 1810 over at the old Bethel Church, where Robert Marshall was the minister, and talk about this thing. They talked about it and could not agree. But they did agree to meet the next year at Mount Tabor in 1811 and argue this matter to its logical conclusion. So Thompson and Marshall had written a paper, I've read it, setting forth what they believed to be the kind of creed that they ought to adopt. Martin Stone and David Pervine opposed the writing and the adoption of a creed, and when they finally put it to a vote of the representatives who were there, they voted overwhelmingly to reject the creed and accept the Bible as their only rule of faith and practice and follow the Bible and the Bible alone. You know what I asked myself when I studied this? What if they had voted otherwise? What if that delegate assembly had said, yes, we need a creed? We never have been happy since we left the Westminster Confession of Faith or the Philadelphia Confession of Faith or the Old English Prayer Book. We ought to write one comparably. Where would we be today as the church? Wouldn't there have been a great battle later then to have thrown off that creed? But some of my brethren today are acting as if they think we ought to write a creed indicating what the church stands for and what it believes and what the practices of the church are and should be. Well, on December of 1811, Marshall and Thompson left the Restoration Movement and went back to the Presbyterians. They said, if you won't write a creed, we're going back to the people who have one. And they went back to the Presbyterians and were readmitted in 1807. Now, with the defection of McNamara and Dunleavy to the Shakers, and with the return of Marshall and Thompson to the Presbyterians, the only ones left were Stone and Reuben Dooley and David Pervance, and Pervance was living in Ohio. Now, can't you imagine that was a lonely climate? And can't you imagine that he felt forsaken? Even at times that God had forsaken him. And asked why. Why, he said, they've all left me, and those who are here are so much against me, they want to take my life. But he rallied from that kind of situation, and he and Reuben Dooley decided on the death of their wives that they would farm out their young children among the brethren, and they would hit the road preaching, he said, and establishing churches. Now, do you think this is shades of the New Testament day? Talk about restoration. Well, this goes right back to the heart of the New Testament practices. The New Testament church fought Judaism and Pharisaism, Sadduceeism, everything else. And then finally won the upper hand of it and went out and established churches all over Asia and into Europe, as we've studied. Well, that's what they did. And they went about the job of doing this. Now in 1814, Stone decided he'd leave Kentucky and come out here at Goodlettsville, because he was under the impression that his mother-in-law had promised him the farm. And he'd go down there and take over the farm and preach throughout this land and farm this land as his own. Well, after he got down there and discussed the matter with his mother-in-law, he misread her, misinterpreted her, and she refused to let him have the farm. Well, he had no other choice but to hightail it back to Kentucky. And when he got back to Kentucky, he found he couldn't buy his farm back for what he sold it, and didn't have enough money to buy it at the price they placed on it. So he went to live in Lexington, instead of back out at Cane Ridge. When he came back to Kentucky, he established the Old Hill Street Church in 1816. This was the first church of the Restoration Movement established in Lexington, Kentucky. And Stone did it at the Old Hill Street Church. And then in 1819, he left Lexington and went to Georgetown. And in Georgetown, he established a restored church and became principal of the old Rittenhouse Academy. Now, it came to the ears of Stone by this time that Campbell was doing the same thing in West Virginia and Pennsylvania and northeastern Ohio that he was doing in Kentucky and Tennessee and in southern Ohio. So they decided that the Christians of the Stone movement and the reformers of the Campbell movement ought to get together. They ought to talk out the situation, talk out their plea and their positions, and so they did. Now, you'll remember that Campbell had not come to Kentucky until 1823. He came to Kentucky to debate W.L. McCullough over at Washington in Mason County, and rode horseback with Sidney Rigdon all of the way from Bethany, West Virginia, to Washington near Maysville, Kentucky today to debate. That's the first time he'd been there. Stone didn't attend that debate because he thought it was a squabble between one of his brethren, McCullough, who was sort of an oddball anyhow, and a Baptist preacher from Bethany, West Virginia. He didn't go. He'd never seen Campbell. But in 1824, Campbell returned to Kentucky. And when he did, he visited Stone at his home in Georgetown. And Stone had bought a home that had been owned by Israel Boone, a nephew of Daniel Boone. Now that old home had been lost to us for generations. And 2 years ago, we found that old home out there and located it. And it's open for your visitation if you go there. Now, when Campbell and Stone talked, they found in the main they agreed. But they found that they disagreed on such subjects as baptism for the remission of sins, the observance of the Lord's Supper every Sunday, and the explicit influence of the Holy Spirit in conversion and the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. Campbell believed one way and Stone believed another way. But after a long period of conversation, Stone said that we agreed in the main with one another and that our causes paralleled and represented one another and ought to be merged. Over at Millersburg in Bourbon County, Stone had established a congregation and Campbell's people had established a congregation. Here you have a group of reformers after the Campbell order and a group of Christians after the Stone order. Well, this is a small town, and they learned about each other and found out that their views were the same and that their views really were coterminous, and they decided to become one, and they united and merged and organized one Restoration congregation in the city of Millersburg. Stone was preaching at Georgetown, and John T. Johnson was preaching out at Grace Crossing. Now, John T. Johnson was a Campbell convert, and Barton Warren Stone had found the truth himself. But they changed pulpits and found that they were preaching about the same thing. And so they invited John Rogers and Raccoon John Smith to come over for a meeting with them. Raccoon John Smith was preaching at Mount Sterling in Montgomery County, and John Rogers was preaching in Carlisle over in Nicholas County. Now, Stone had converted Rogers, and Campbell had converted Johnson and Smith. So these four, representing the Reformers and the Christian, decided to meet, and they met on Christmas Day. I don't know where Santa Claus was, but they met on Christmas Day of 1831 in Georgetown to talk over their differences. Well, they too decided that their views were similar, but they did not constitute a large enough body to represent a merger or a uniting of the forces or a union of the Christians and Reformers. So they called for a larger meeting to meet in Lexington, Kentucky at the old Hill Street Church on New Year's Day of 1832. Now, I don't know where the Super Bowl was played that day, but they weren't interested in Santa Claus or the Super Bowl either. And they met on the first day of January of 1832 to discuss this matter. Well, finally, they decided for Raccoon John Smith to make the valedictory address and set forth what they had meant to do. And Barton Warren Stone was selected to follow him, to either challenge what he said or express agreement in what he had said and recommend that the course that he set forth would be followed. Well, if you have not read Raccoon John Smith's speech at that meeting, you ought to find a volume that will tell you about it. And you ought to read it too. It's a masterpiece as he set forth the basis of union and unity between these two groups. And as he finished, here Stone arose and said, I have not one thing in disagreement with what the brother has said. And I here and now give him my hand. And they shook hands, representing the unity of these two groups and the binding of them together. Ah, this is another highlight in the restoration movement, is it? Where all of them who are preaching the Bible and who are calling men back to the Bible and who are practicing what the Bible teaches Christians to teach have all said we're going to do it the same way and we'll be one. And so they chose Raccoon John Smith and John Rogers to go among the churches and tell them the good news. And John T. Smith volunteered to raise the money to finance them on this journey, and they went forth. Great day of unity. That's the only way we could unite today, would be on the same basis that they united on. We'd have no trouble in the church today if we would just take what they taught, or what they took and teach what they taught and practice what they practice, because they got it from the Bible, and that's where we can get it to do. Well, it continued this way for some time, as you know, until 1849, when a group of people met in Cincinnati, Ohio, and voted to organize and affiliate congregations with the American Christian Missionary Society. The result of that meeting, my brethren, divided the restoration right down the middle. Some of them became society churches, and some of them non-society churches. Great hindrance it was. 10 years later, L.L. Pinkerton decided that the singing was so bad at the old Midway Church in Midway, Kentucky, that even the rats could not inhabit the meeting house. They were scared away with the screeching and squalling, he said, of the people who sang. And so he decided that the church ought to introduce a melodeon as an assistance to their singing, to help with their singing, and so he introduced a melodeon. This further divided the church. Those who were with the Missionary Society accepted the organ. Those who were against the Missionary Society rejected the organ. So you have one group of churches who are missionary organ churches. Another group who are non-missionary and non-organ churches. And that great division moved in the brotherhood and finally resulted in what we have today, of three groups of people claiming to have roots in the restoration movement. The Church of Christ, which is non-organ and non-society, and the Christian Church, which is non-society and organ, and the Disciples of Christ, which are everything. And anything you can name that the Disciples of Christ would not advocate that they could do. So we have these three groups today as divided Christendom in what one time was a united restoration movement. And so great was its potential that Alexander Campbell taught that if individuals accepted what they had taught, we'd have a millennium in this world of ours. And I suspect we would have, and I expect we would today.